This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everyone. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And thank you very much, everybody who is here to catch us live or is grabbing us on the podcast later. We appreciate you taking an hour of your day to spend some time with us. And if you are with us live and you are so predisposed, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the chat room. You can roll in there with the usual suspects. And if you have a point of order or an observation about the show, that's a great place to share it. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show because it's also a good place. If there is a question you would like for us to ask our guests, that's a great place to put it in there, and we'll grab it and try to fold it in as the show moves forward. And if you got a runoff halfway through the show and you want to catch up on what you may have missed, you can always get the full archive over Blog Talk Radio or just get the free podcast over at iTunes or Stitcher. Now let's go ahead and dive into today's show. And it really should be an entire seminar, but we're going to try to do a full semester here in the course of an hour. But one fun thing about 2017 is for the first time in 8 years, we have a change in political parties and the leadership of the executive branch. And because of that, even though occasionally when you have one party turn over to the other, there's a fair bit of turnover, when you have a new party come in, you have a whole new team that comes throughout the executive branch. And perhaps not as closely understood or appreciated in the general population is the national security leadership and the wide variety of areas that are involved in national security, both foreign and domestic. They have a change of leadership tone and perhaps emphasis. And we figure this is a good time not only to perhaps talk a little bit about how that process works and why you should be concerned about it, but look at who is who in the zoo and exactly what they do. Because when you look at the alphabet soup of organizations out there that have their toes in the national security arena, and by far not an exhaustive list here, you have the things that you usually hear about in a variety of places if you keep up to speed. The NSC, the NSA, the CIA, DOD, DIA, DHS, DNI, and all those organizations in theory are supposed to work together and in a little bit of creative friction that's healthy to any organization in competition to enhance national security. And though everybody likes to bash bureaucracies, and we've all been frustrated with them, they are critically important that these large organizations function. And they're only as good as the people that are hired to populate and lead them. And we've got a great guest on today to help us understand and perhaps get a better feel for what's going on navigating the inside of the national security infrastructure. And that would be Lauren DeYoung-Schulman. Lauren is the Deputy Director of Studies and the Leon Panetta Senior Fellow at the Center for the New American Security. She most recently served as Senior Advisor to National Security Advisor Susan Rice. Before returning to the White House in 2013, she was Chief of Staff to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. She has served as the Director for Defense Policy on the National Security Council staff from 2011 to 12. And prior to that was a special assistant to the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates. She is a native Texan and all that comes with it, mom to the most awesome pizza-lover two-year-old ever. And as Lauren and I occasionally communicate on a regular basis, she's also a great person to follow over on Twitter. Lauren, at long last, welcome to Midrats.
I am incredibly excited to be here. My toddler is just... You'll be clear to everybody, eating pizza at this time, so we will not have any interruptions by two-year-olds during the middle of our discussion, which I am incredibly excited about.
Well, thank you very much, and hopefully you brought enough pizza. If he's anything like I was at his age, yeah, you'll hit through it pretty fast.
Yep.
Just to start things off, Lauren, I remember one of those phrases I'm old enough to remember. I'm old enough to remember that right after 9/11, there was this great push and this idea that we had all these different organizations that are involved in national security, and maybe they don't communicate as well as they should, and we ought to put in a new infrastructure and new organizations to better, hopefully, you know, synchronize and get things together. And, you know, goodness knows we have over a decade and a half behind us since that really started. And just to kick off, and maybe as an opportunity for you to outline the different phylums in the ecosystem of national security, so to speak, go back to what the goal of that was and where we find ourselves a decade and a half later. Do you think we are in a better situation than we were when we made that push after 9/11? And what are some of the major players that, at least in the political sense, people should expect perhaps a different focus than what they saw in a previous administration?
Sure. So that's actually a great point to start at. So after, as you point out, after 9/11, there's a recognition that we were doing a number of things as U.S. government pretty poorly. The intelligence community wasn't doing a great job sharing intelligence. We didn't really have a cohesive way to communicate about what we has become termed homeland security at the time between different organizations. And there was no belly button in the White House to say, we are the ones who are here to look at protecting the homeland beyond just military, beyond the, you know, like missile defense or other kinds of aspects of the Department of Defense side of homeland security. So they did what they always do in Washington when you have a new idea or a new threat. It created a few new organizations. First one being the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which is set up to do a number of things, but partially to kind of serve as an overseer and coordinator of intelligence coming from the, you know, half dozen different intelligence agencies, actually more than that, different intelligence agencies in government. Set up the Department of Homeland Security, which brings together, as most folks know, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, TSA, Customs and Border Patrol, a couple other organizations feed into the Homeland Security side. And then also, because we need something at the White House, they created the Homeland Security Council as a partner to the National Security Council in order to bring together the different organizations that would talk about, you know, terrorist threats to the United States, pandemic threats, immigration policy, refugee policy, a lot of the things that were important national security issues, but always kind of got second shrift compared to, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan or China or Russia or things like that. It's created, you know, added a lot of new organizations, added a lot of new people to staff those organizations. And then, of course, when we had a change of administration from the Bush administration to the Obama administration, because we like to move around deck chairs in Washington, they kind of switched it up a little bit again by, you know, they kept the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, they kept Department of Homeland Security and actually made it larger, and then kind of recombined National Security and Homeland Security Council at the White House, because there was a fear that by actually separating it, you were making it a lot lower priority. There's always different organizational theories that behind the rearranging of org charts in D.C. So they recombined them at the White House. They kind of grew the staff and combined the staff at the White House for the National Security Council and Homeland Security Council, and basically kind of added a senior level person at the White House to report to the president on homeland security matters, with a much more of a focus on counterterrorism, both in for homeland but also internationally. So where we find ourselves now, going from the Obama administration to the Trump administration, you've heard a lot of talk about how, you know, Mike Flynn, former Lieutenant General, has a long intelligence career as a national security advisor. His deputy is KT McFarland, who is kind of oversees the rest of the National Security Council process at a deputy's level. There's another guy hanging out at the White House, Tom Bossert, who I don't know his exact title. It's Assistant to the President for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. Nobody's quite sure how that's different from the Obama administration, but they say that it is. And theoretically, they've restarted the Homeland Security Council. But this is all fairly new, and people are reading a lot in the memos that have come out in the last month or so to see, like, how is it that the Trump administration is rearranging things? So that's who we have at the White House. And as you mentioned, like, we have all this turnover at all the agencies, because for the most part, except for the FBI director, these are political positions that you have as the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, the Director of National Intelligence, Director of CIA. All of these folks are political appointees. They're among 4,000 political appointees that turn over every administration, to include some, I think it's like 400 or so at the Department of Defense. I don't know how many at the White House, the National Security Council, and others at the Department of State. So in this month, we have a lot of new folks who are running our national security and homeland security, who are at the same time of, you know, caring about a North Korea missile test over the weekend. They're also trying to figure out, like, where's my desk? Where are the pencils? Where's the bathroom? Where do I get lunch? And the kind of day-to-day, what is my job and responsibilities here in Washington? And a lot of these folks haven't served in government before. So we're in kind of a dicey period right now where, you know, it wouldn't have mattered if it was Hillary Clinton or President Trump turning over, that the first month or 6 weeks or so is a kind of a shaky moment in national security, where I think adversaries are looking to test us a bit to see, you know, how this administration going to react? How do they react if we push them a bit? How do they react if we're friendly? And who's who in the zoo in terms of, like, who's the actual lead dog in the pack for national security? So I'll stop there as I've droned on about my wonky love of national security process.
Well, this is Mark. I'm Eagle One. It's not so wonky, and it's interesting because I hadn't, until we announced we were going to be on the show and I did some research, I had no idea what the National Security Council did and who the heck all these players are. Can you kind of run down? I know this is kind of maybe out of your bailiwick a little bit. Kind of run down the history of the National Security Council and the National Security Advisor, and, you know, how all that kind of meshes with where we are today. Is that too wonky?
No, that's awesome. That's, like, as my cousin would say, that is my jam. All right, so history of the National Security Council. In 1947, Congress passed the National Security Act, which set up the National Security Council. It also set up the Joint Staff and a couple other things, also launched the Air Force and a bunch of other really fun national security geeky facts. But the National Security Council, they said we have the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, they say would be on it at the time. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs would be an advisor to this council, and a couple other members that they listed to say, that led by the president, here's what the National Security Council is. Interestingly, when Congress came up with the National Security Council, they did not come up with the idea of a national security advisor. They said that, you know, that you can have staff that supports the National Security Council, that, you know, anytime, like during the Cuban Missile Crisis or in the Korean War, like, the staff would be in charge of pulling together options and views from departments to, you know, like, staff a meeting or to staff a decision process by the president. But they didn't envision originally that there would be anyone besides the president that would be kind of at the head of a table in a national security meeting process. That came a bit later. So Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, like, they each had very different National Security Council process and style. They eventually did come up with having the concept of a National Security Advisor, which basically meant that, you know, before an issue got to the president, there would be somebody else who gathered all of these lead agencies around the table to say, all right, we've got a crisis in Korea. We have a crisis in China. We have a crisis somewhere else in the world. What is the intelligence picture? What is the diplomatic picture? What are our military options? Where are our military assets? And then what are the options that we can bring to the president? Because otherwise, I mean, we've all been there before. You don't want to be in a meeting with your boss and be discussing something for the first time. So by putting a national security advisor, you're effectively allowing the president to delegate some of his kind of coordinating responsibility for the NSC. There's also below the national security advisor, and this is again didn't come in immediately. There's traditionally a deputy, at least one deputy national security advisor, and sometimes many more than that, where they do similarly. They pull together an interagency discussion process from state, from Department of Defense, from the Office of National Intelligence, from CIA, to even lower level issues that they will tee up to their bosses, and will then tee up to the president. What this results in sometimes is that, the president can say, I don't need to decide everything on our Africa food assistance program, because that's not worth his time. So he can delegate down to lower, the deputies committee, in this case led by KT McFarland, to say, look, you guys decide all of our Africa foreign assistance. That doesn't need to come to me. Or more on the military side, he could have said, President Obama, for example, could have said, look, I don't need to decide anytime we do a freedom of navigation exercise in the South China Sea. It doesn't need to come all the way to me. Just decide it at a much, much lower level. But that tends to vary by administration in terms of what people are comfortable delegating. And then, of course, there's a lot of issues that don't need to go to the NSC at all. They can just be decided by the agencies itself, or the Secretary of Defense can call up the Secretary of State and be like, hey, are you cool with this? And issues close. But because DC loves bureaucracy and loves to have meetings, you see it's fair to say increasingly more and more issues go from being just a one agency issue or just a two agency issue to being something that people feel compelled to sit around a table in a situation room and debate, which means that you have people who are ostensibly in charge of running a huge organization. DoD is a 2 million person organization. It has a $500 billion budget. And the people that are in charge of it spend maybe a third of their week sometimes sitting in the situation room working on issues for the president. So, which, that's arguably part of the responsibility. They are by law members of the National Security Council, but they also have other day jobs to do too. And that ends up having kind of a detrimental effect on their ability to, act really effectively support the president and also, do the management of the Department of Defense or Department of State or travel that they need to do or come up with what our healthcare system is at DOD and other things that are not necessarily in the NSC process.
Wanted to stick with the National Security Council for a bit because one of the curious things I'm glad I had it on mute because I started laughing and making the comments about meetings. I mean, we've all been there where you're into hour three of a meeting with wall hangers and everybody else, and you go, we've accomplished about 10 minutes of useful work at this point. But let's talk about the National Security Council for a bit, because when you look back to the 1970s to where it is today, there's been substantial growth in that bureaucracy, in the amount of personnel that are assigned to it. And from a curious point of view, where do you think most of that has come from? Is it just natural bureaucratic growth where if having three deputies is good, four is better, and if four is good, then five is better? And how much of that is expanded responsibility? And if it's that, where has the National Security Council taken responsibilities from that historically had taken care of it inside of the national security infrastructure?
So there's a ton of reasons for it. One that doesn't get discussed very much is, say in the 70s, you did not have real-time information flow from all over the world, from every embassy, from every combatant command, from every military operation. And that has made a tremendous difference in terms of what people feel like they have to be aware of and responsive to and, able to sack the president on, rightly or wrongly. So just by comparison, if There's a couple of famous cables that Ambassador Eikenberry sent at the beginning of the Obama administration about his view on our strategy in Afghanistan. So that was actually a really tightly held cable, but so just to back up a bit, so cables are, you know, something that the State Department uses frequently to communicate back to the State Department, back to the president and elsewhere to say, hey, I had this meeting, it went really well, or here's my view on a broader strategy issue. It's their version of email, but back to an antiquated term. So anyway, when he sent this, it should have been really closely held, and it certainly would have been 20, 30 years ago. But because it's all on computers now, this kind of flashes around the entire interagency. Lots of people have seen it and are aware of it. It ends up being leaked. And it goes from being something that was more or less a private communication to the president and a few people to being something that everybody is aware of and feels like they have to be responsive to. They have to care about it and do something about it. And yet you see similar things with intelligence that comes back, or I remember even during Operation Unified Protector in Libya, having to report up to my boss to say, how many drone strikes had we taken that day, which is just a crazy tactical question for us to be, giving to a senior national security member. So a lot of it is information flow where did not exist before. And so people feel like, I need more people to read all of that. I need more people to staff it. I need more people to think about it and to report to the president. I think that in probably 5, 10 years, this is wishful thinking. Hopefully at some point we will get used to the fact that we have Twitter, 24/7 news, way more information coming from the field, and start to process the fact that I don't have to, as an NSC staffer, own all of that. I don't need to know all of it. My job is not to know everything. It's to offer advice on things when I need to, not to become kind of the resident universal sucking sound of information. So that's one reason. I think another one is in terms of the National Security Council staff, for example, has gone from, 40 people in the 70s to theoretically it's somewhere in the few hundreds right now. That depends on how you measure it, but let's say 350 or so. Some of that is because we've added Homeland Security as a bigger responsibility. People are aware we need to be paying more attention to Homeland Security as a coordinated and coherent issue rather than just different silos of information. Some of it is that I would say a recognition that international economic issues, trade, sanctions, another number of other economic policies, these all have national security implications, and we should have people who are communicating those back and forth across national security interest areas, whereas before we might have just had the National Economic Council who's working on something and not really communicating as much with the NSC. The next thing I would say is, whereas probably in the 80s, we had a huge, in the 70s, had a huge Russia office or larger Russia office and maybe a couple of people working in the Middle East or a couple of people working in Asia. The size of offices that are working at the National Security Council on the Middle East, on Southeast Asia, on Africa, on counterterrorism, all of these have grown substantially. And you can probably make a decent case that all of those issues have become more important to us from a national security perspective. Or you could also make the case that those issues were always important to us from a national security perspective, but now we just have more meanings on them. But in terms of the larger bureaucracy, what's interesting if you look at DOD versus State Department versus the intelligence community, the State Department hasn't gotten a whole lot larger in the last couple of decades. The Defense Department has to some degree, and then it shrank again, and then now theoretically it may be getting bigger again. On the civilian side, it got a lot bigger. On the contractor side, it got a lot bigger. The intelligence community has gone through it's less periods of growth and more that they have shifted resources from certain areas to other areas because it takes a long time. You may be able to hire quickly in certain pieces of government, but it takes a long time to build expertise in a way that's actually making any difference at all. So even if you, you know, double the size of your staff at the Defense Intelligence Agency or the CIA or elsewhere, you don't really feel the impact of that for like 5-10 years down the road when you've actually managed to build an expert. So I think in some ways we have grown in ways that is not terribly useful to us as a government, because it takes so long to feel the impact. Basically, if you say that I'm going to double the size of my, you know, countering violent extremism staff, like even if you did that, if hired 30 more people tomorrow, it's going to take several years to actually have an impact. So it takes a while for U.S. government to say, yep, this size makes sense to me because I totally understand the requirements process for this. Like there's not a requirements process. There's not like anybody doing any kind of analytics on the size and the scope of U.S. government national security personnel. It's much more of a sort of an instinct. We need to double down on this and grow excessively.
In listening to all that, I'm trying to figure out where we get the people who know what they're doing into this system. I mean, I've seen this Scowcroft model, and I guess there are other models. And I mean, is there some other than OJT? Is there some magic training program to get people up to speed in the National Security Council and how it's supposed to function and what its functions are?
Good question, and actually one that, to be honest with you, I think that even the National Security Council staff itself struggles with, because so much of what the NSC is and does on a day-to-day basis is really a function of the president and the function of his personality and what he or she wants to do with that staff and with that organizing function. And for example, like, you know, people talk a lot about how President Obama's national security staff micromanaged a lot. And part of that was just part of the president's personality. It was, you saw it across multiple national security advisors that have very, very different perspectives on this issue, but there was consistency in how that the Obama administration, you know, kind of elevated issues up to senior levels that, you know, previously might have been something that would have gone to an agency. And similar thing what you see with President Trump, where he is the news that came out a few weeks ago that he's including his chief strategist, Steve Bannon, on the NSC. So what that basically means for those who haven't been following as much, the NSC, as I mentioned before, is, you know, a list of people that gather to debate national security issues, and is traditionally people who have very, you know, professionalized national security roles. Never in the last 7 years have you had somebody who has a political role, other than the president who is elected, in having that NSC debate. So if having Steve Bannon at the table is very much a stamp of how President Trump feels about national security issues, that there is a political tinge to those that he wants to be included in that debate. And so as a result of that, kind of going back to your original question, like the NSC staff itself, which is largely career people who are sent from other agencies, so they may be military officers, they may be State Department diplomats, they may be intelligence staff from the Central Intelligence Agency, and elsewhere, like it's like 90% or so people who had their careers in government who are not political appointees. So the people who are staffing this process have to adjust from the Obama administration, which was, you know, had one kind of flavor of personality of how the NSC process works, to the Trump administration, which by all appearances, incredibly different. And same thing when they went from Steve Hadley, who was a national security advisor under President Bush, to then General Jones, the first national security advisor under President Obama. Despite the fact that like NSC or national security policy tends to be very consistent from administration to administration, the process by which it operates is radically different every time because the personalities change so much at the top and their desires about how to, you know, think about NSC process works. I think the best learning process I've had for the NSC, other than just like being there myself for a couple of turns, was to read Robert Gates' book, Duty. There's a couple of chapters about the Afghanistan policy review in 2009, where they're debating whether or not to substantially expand the number of troops in Afghanistan. Ultimately, you know, they had the debates about do we want to have a counterterrorism force, counterterrorism plus, or whatever else they called it. But he goes through just it's like reading a romance novel, but with like on civil relations, where there's all of this back and forth between the Department of Defense and the Department of State and the NSC staff and the president and the chief of staff and others on how this review process of reviewing our Afghanistan strategy should work. And kind of buried within that, whether he intended to or not, is some really key lessons about how Bob Gates, who is a complete pro, thinks national security process should run and the mistakes that he saw the Obama administration make in terms of how they communicated with military leaders or how they let some of this debate spill into the public when it should have been much more of a kind of private conversation on our strategy in Afghanistan and how all of these issues relate to our relationship with Congress. So I think it's like chapters 4 and 5 of Duty. So I highly recommend if anyone is sort of fascinated by how NSC process has worked really poorly, but also how it maybe worked really positively in the past, that the Robert Gates, who my former boss, total hero of mine, does a really great job of going through a lot of that in his Afghanistan policy discussion.
Yeah, I just want to second that about Gates. Specifically, that book absolutely should be on everybody's list. And if you haven't read it in a while, read it a second time. If you ever want to hear the operational side of that, I was actually at HQ ISAF when the transition was going on. I've got some funny stories for a different day. I want to pull the thread on that. It involves black SUVs and distill gardens.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just pull the thread on what we're talking about here, because, and I'm probably getting the cliche wrong, but people are policy. And
yep.
We have 4,000 political appointees, and there's always a little bit of a rushing about when you go between administrations. But something that was rather unique about this is there was not one way to look at the Trump administration, the Trump candidacy, was an insurgency candidacy. It wasn't just against the other political party. It was against the own political party he was ostensibly running under the banner with. And there was a lot of great professionals with centuries of combined national policy experience, many of which we both know, that were part of the Never Trump Brigade. And as a result, after the election, it was a study of contrast. You had an already established Democratic Party national security team and people who had been working with or consulting with Hillary Clinton and her host of advisors for years, had boxes full of cell phones, and they were already arguing with each other or who was getting which office and which parking spot. And then at some time around 9:30 Eastern, the other side of the political spectrum went, okay, now what? We still have this huge national security infrastructure. Obviously, the people from the Hillary Clinton team aren't going to change outfits and attitudes and jump on. There's a large part of the other political parties' national security apparatus that have taken themselves out of the equation. And we have this, what appears to be, depending upon where you read, a very spotty, clunky transition. And I was wondering, of those big group, how many really need to be approved by the Senate? Because until they get there, a lot of them aren't going to be able to approve their deputies. And historically, if you want to draw the line at the transition from Johnson to Nixon, that'll be fine. But historically, when it comes to flushing out the positions here, are we ahead of the curve plus or minus half a standard deviation from the curve, or is this really backing up on getting people in a position to take charge?
Those are all great questions. So out of the 4,000 political appointees, not all of which are in the national security space, I think it's about 1,000 that require Senate confirmation. In the NSC space, I don't even want to hazard a guess, but like, you know, just to give people a picture. So at, you know, the Department of Defense, you have the Secretary of Defense, you have his deputy, you have 5 undersecretaries that report to him. You have, I think, something around like 15 or 16 or so assistant secretaries that you know, work on anything from Asia policy to acquisition policy to, you know, the comptroller budget function that all report up as well. And then you have their service secretaries, all of which that have several confirmed positions there. And at DOD, all of those are empty except for Secretary Mattis, who was confirmed very quickly. And then they asked Bob Work, the deputy secretary, to stay on. You have a similar situation at State where you have Secretary Tillerson, but then the rest of his, basically the rest of his appointed undersecretaries, deputy secretary, and assistant secretaries, as well as a lot of political ambassadors who were, you know, are the U.S. representative overseas, those spots are all empty, except for, I think, the undersecretary for political affairs, who is a career ambassador and has stayed in place. So in terms of, you know, a historical perspective, back at least a few administrations, we are seriously behind the curve in terms of confirmations. And that is largely because people haven't been named. Just by comparison back to the Obama administration, I worked on the transition between the Bush and Obama administration in 2008. And we knew who some of the service secretaries, several of the undersecretaries, the deputy secretary, we knew who all of them would be by now. And I believe it's true to say that all, just for example, so all of the 5 undersecretaries that report to the Secretary of Defense, they were all confirmed by now. Now, we're at a point right now where we're still playing the guessing game of who will join this administration. And, you know, to your point about the Never Trump letter, so what's interesting about that is if you think about, like, okay, so who could not sign the Never Trump letter, which is still theoretically they are not, as an administration, encouraging people who signed it to join the Trump administration at all. So people who work on the Hill who are Senate staffers or Hill staffers or even members of Congress themselves, though they couldn't sign it, though I guess they could, you know, personally say, like, I'm against Trump or I'm for Trump. You might, you know, this varies, but there are some people who think that, you know, certainly former general officers, but perhaps retired military, they may have a sense of a personal feeling of whether or not they should be endorsing or not endorsing candidates. And that's not a hard and fast rule, but I think that you know, if you did a poll, you would have a number of people who would say, like, I'm not getting into that discussion. And then you have the business community, which some of them may have personally done it, but they're not organizing on it on national security issues to say, I'm never going to work in the Trump administration on national security issues. So that leaves you with an interesting pool of people who may be appointees here. So you, like, for example, at the National Security Council staff, you see a number of Mike Flynn's former associates in the military intelligence community who are retired military from primarily from the Army, but there's been a couple from the Marine Corps as well, who are serving as his key senior staff at the NSC. And that's fairly atypical, not that you wouldn't see people with prior military experience, but that you would see so many that coming in with a similar military intelligence background to serve in the what we call a senior director position on the NSC staff. And I have to wonder if we're going to see similar examples of that in some of the appointees you have at DOD, perhaps at the State Department and elsewhere, where you may have people that come in from each of those kind of buckets of people that I mentioned where they couldn't sign for, or either couldn't sign or would be less inclined perhaps to sign a Never Trump letter. But then again, I have to imagine at some point, like I know that they have considered folks who, you know, stood up and said, like, there's no way I can ever support Trump. And then suddenly you hear rumors that they're being considered for example, Deputy Secretary of Defense or Deputy Secretary of State, and maybe willing to, in service of country, just go ahead, bite the bullet and say, I will absolutely serve in this administration, particularly under somebody like General Mattis. Sorry, Secretary Mattis. But the problem we have right now in terms of being behind, in terms of, you know, confirmations and getting people in the room. So back to the NSC process. So if there's a crisis, for example, the North Korea missile test this weekend, what typically happens, for good or bad, is that in the Obama administration, they would have probably called a deputies committee, whether in person or over a secure phone. And that means that all of the deputies from those departments, from DOD, from state, from the intelligence community and elsewhere, would get on the line and talk about, here's what happened, here are our response options, let's assign somebody to draft a statement, assign some people to call the Japanese, to call China, to call our allies, and say, you know, here's our response that we're going to do. We encourage you to do so too. So we have acting people in a lot of those positions, but for all that, they are incredible public servants and they are doing an amazing job of keeping the trains running on time. They are not trusted Trump administration personnel. And they are also, because they are a large part, you know, civil servants who have stayed on through every administration to take acting positions in these roles, they're not going to go off and do or propose something that is too edgy or too potentially political or something that may get them perceived as being too aligned with the prior administration. So they're probably going to be fairly safe in their behavior. Like if they're called into a deputies committee meeting. So it's just a different atmosphere, particularly in a crisis where you'd normally have all of these political appointees from the Trump administration who are hopefully trusted people who understand Trump's vision for national security, and who are, you know, able to act on his behalf. And, you know, have a good sense of like what his views or Mike Flynn's views are. Instead, we're just pretty well stifled right now. Like we are in a very odd spot where I have completely lost his name, General Selva, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who is one deputy who is actually in place. You have KT McFarland, and you have some members of the intelligence community, and the rest of these spots are empty. So, a North Korea missile test, that's bad, and we need to have a response, but it's not a full-blown crisis. I worry a lot about what's going to happen and how people are going to really kind of advise the president if we have a full-on crisis where we really truly do need to come up with urgent options that are not on already, you know, on the books for the president in terms of how to respond. Like, that's going to be something that going to kind of shock the system no matter what happens, and folks are going to be looking for, you know, who are my military planners, who are the people who know Iran policy backwards and forwards, you know, who are the people that have done this before, and those are just like unknown questions to the team right now.
Well, but that raises a great question. I think you kind of posed it early on while we were talking, that is there a way to prevent this kind of, I mean, I'll go back. Usually when I start a job, it takes me a few months to learn how to do the job, really, you know, learn who the players are, all that kind of stuff, just what you talked about, where the bathroom is, where to eat, all that good stuff. Is there a way to speed up that process for an incoming administration, by mandating somehow that, you know, they have these key advisors in place before inauguration so they can kind of get up to speed rather than coming in late? I mean, is there an approach in our form of government that we don't go through this every time we have a transition between different parties and different presidents?
So this one is particularly odd because, I mean, normally you have people coming out of the woodwork begging to be a part of an administration. And you have, I know that Hillary Clinton's campaign had, you know, for every assistant secretary position, they had at least like three or four people in mind that could possibly take the role. Not only could possibly take it, but wanted to and would maybe probably get confirmed decently easily. And you know, the Trump administration, for a number of reasons, namely that they just weren't sure that they were going to win, didn't do a lot of that preparation. So what we've actually done in the last couple of transitions, which is new and great, is, I mean, first mandating that the U.S. government overall prepare for transition. And, you know, some of this is kind of lame where, you know, every agency is going to prepare these really big, thick binders for everybody coming in and to read and absorb and understand, you know, what are our priority security assistance priorities and, you know, what's the COOPCOG plan and things like that, continuity of operations, continuity of government. But at the same time, one interesting thing that Congress did in this last election was tell both campaigns, you guys can start preparing for transition earlier. As soon as your nominee is named for each party, you can start getting access to U.S. government spaces and U.S. government resources to think about transition and to even start thinking about like what people are going to be in place. Because previously, you know, five elections ago, if a candidate had come out and said, like, look, I've got candidate lists for all these jobs, I'm already starting to think about my first 100 day priorities, that was seen as, frankly, just quite inappropriate. But as now, what Congress intended was that it be expected and that they would all be taking these steps. Something else that they required in this administration, which I wish they had done more of, so in the 2008 Bush to Obama transition, they kind of at the last minute did this counterterrorism tabletop exercise where the goal of it was less to really get through the exercise and more to teach the incoming team, you know, look, these are the resources you have access to. You know, if we had an attack on the homeland, here's the kind of people that you would call. Here's the capabilities that we have as a government. Here's how, you know, sometimes our funding stream doesn't work exactly as you would think it would. And here's where you would need to involve Congress, so on and so forth. It was really meant to be a tutorial. My sense was that this administration was prepared to do this and much, much more for the incoming team, but for the incoming Trump team. But because they had so many changes in their transition team, you'll recall, you know, Chris Christie left, Mike Rogers left, the people who were running transition for the Trump administration, they kind of turned over considerably. So they didn't take advantage of a lot of that. And I think a lot of the people that maybe their initial transition team had on a slate of candidates, so like, you know, this guy would be a great assistant secretary of defense for, you know, Asia Pacific. Those candidate lists were kind of seen as not useful. So I think Congress has actually given transition teams and political candidates a lot of tools to make transitions run decently smoothly. And, you know, most people, I mean, to be honest, like I was on part of the Hillary Clinton transition effort. I mean, we were all sufficiently freaked out enough of like, wow, this is going to come really fast. You only have 2.5 months to prepare. They're, you know, ready to start working their asses off as soon as, you know, as soon as election night is over and you're ready to go in and start meeting with your agency counterparts. One thing that Congress and OPM have allowed that I don't think this administration, or frankly many prior ones, have taken much advantage of, they can do a lot more left seat, right seat transitions than they really allow for. So, you know, there's all these stories about, like, you know, how scandalous it is that all of these Obama appointees are asked to resign on January 20th. Like, they were told by the President Obama, like, everybody turn in your resignation letter on January 20th or for January 20th, regardless. The Trump administration will have the ability to say, like, nope, I don't want you to resign. I want you to stick around. And they did that in some cases. But what we don't take enough advantage of is, like, you can actually do that in all cases and just keep the guy in the job even after you've appointed the new person to let them sit side by side and learn from one another about, like, look, here's not only where the bathroom is and where your parking spot is, but here's what I would do if I got a call and there was a nuclear test in North Korea, here's the procedure I would follow, because there's just way too much for a new team to learn very quickly. Like, even if you have the smartest, most competent, most experienced, amazing team in the world, you've never done this job before. And it is just incredibly intimidating to not only have to learn the job that you're assigned to, but also, as all of us who have worked on teams before, to understand what the rest of your National Security Council teammates do, and also just like what their personalities are. I mean, if Mike Flynn says, this is a huge crisis and I need options tomorrow, like, does he really mean that? Or does Mike Flynn just always say that? Like, these are personality quirks that they have to get used to as well. But if they use transition well and use even the time before the election well, they can really be much more prepared than I think this administration necessarily was, again, in large part just because they didn't necessarily think they were going to win.
Yeah, sometimes I think people who haven't been on a staff underestimate the importance of personality management. One of the worst things you can hear on a staff is, nobody's ever worked with this person before, because you don't have anybody you could talk to about, like, okay, what are the hot buttons? Which rib needs to be tickled? So, yeah, that's always an adventure. I wanted to dive into a little bit of a detail here, but also something we just briefly mentioned earlier, is though in a transition, it is, you know, very exciting, all these new people to come with every administration, but behind them, there is a core cadre of career people inside the various national security agencies. That this is their career, regardless of what party is in, what administration is in, that's what they do. And the people aren't laughing too much right now, but I remember a few of the jokes that were bouncing around after the Russians invaded Crimea about a bunch of gray-haired, musty Russia hands wandering around the Pentagon mumbling to themselves with a handful of yellowed Harvard graphic printouts. But of course, Russia is very popular right now. And you can look at both political parties, and inside each political party, you have the huge spectrum to, we need to be friends with Russia, to, yes, Russia is going to be the Antichrist. Both political parties are all over it. And I wonder if some of that might be from the fact that, did we lose what had been a bipartisan and really a nonpartisan cadre of Russia hands who knew the idiosyncrasies of Russia, knew the different challenges, knew the neighborhood, knew the other nations, knew the ethnicities and the religious issues? And, you know, let's go ahead and draw that line at, you know, 2013. Do you feel inside the national security infrastructure we did lose a lot in the period from 91 to 2013? And do you think part of the all over the place in both parties is related to the fact that institutionally we just kind of lost our expertise?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, even if we still kind of maintained the offices and the personnel of people who had spent so much time, you know, dedicated to this study of, you know, Kremlinology and who's who in the zoo in Russia, those, in some cases, those offices just did not have the prominence that they had before. And you would see the hard chargers, the people that you knew were going to have like incredible careers on the military and the civilian side, they, you know, started to be more Middle East focused, or maybe more Asia or China focused. That the, you know, the people in the Russia office, so they were, you know, very reliable, and, you know, they clearly knew their subject matter well. But you recall even in the 2012 election when Governor Romney declared that Russia was one of our top national security threats, people laughed and just thought it was absolutely ridiculous, and people weren't laughing a whole lot later when, as you point out, the invasion of Crimea, all of their actions in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. So I think a lot of it, like, we still have some of that muscle memory within government, but we've had a hard time articulating both with Russia and with China what does it mean to not fully be an adversary, but also not to be best friends, not to be allies? And it's a, you know, it's much, much easier in a national security context to have this very kind of one-dimensional view of a country of like, you are definitely the bad guy, and then I do all the bad guy things to you. It's much more difficult to think about Russia in terms of a country where we have a lot of things that we fundamentally disagree on. We have a lot of things that we they have a lot of things that they do that we have to condemn as a country. But the space program, nuclear non-proliferation, arms control, these are things that we want to continue working with Russia on and need to continue working with Russia on. And I don't think, in some ways, because of like all of the silos of Russia expertise we have throughout government, we never really reached a good way at a kind of mid-level or even to senior-level policymaker way to talk about Russia and to think about Russia, even if that intellectual capacity is there. And if that, there's a lot of people who have come up with like much better ways to strategize about Russia than I can. But the people struggled with the, how do I talk about Russia in a negative way on one side of my mouth one day, and the next day say, gosh, we need them to get to the space station. And that's, for somebody who works on a dozen different issues a day, like that, it's hard for them to grasp that this can be a more complex issue and has to be a more complex issue. And I think we're still struggling with that, both in both political parties and in this administration in particular. You see the General Dunford, I know, is a virulent anti-Russia, you know, Russia is one of the larger threats we have as compared to the President Mike Flynn, who are much more interested in being more cooperative. So I look forward to hearing about their first NSC meeting on Russia and what comes out of that.
Well, we're getting down toward the end of the show, Lauren, and I appreciate you coming on with us. Let me ask you a couple of questions. One is, if people want to know more about the operations of the NSC, is there a good book, like the Rick Anderforth book, they might want to go look at, or are you aware of something else? And secondly, what are you working on that we can tell people to look for in the future so that they'll know more about things that you already know a lot about?
Awesome. So David Rothkopf, who is the editor of Foreign Policy, publisher of Foreign Policy, has written two books on the National Security Council, the latest, which is called National Indecision, and I am forgetting the name of the prior one. Those are both good references, but also kind of good gossipy discussions of not only the national security process and council, but also the impacts of personality on those, as well as a book called Flawed by Design by Amy Ziegert, which is not only about the National Security Council, but also about the intelligence community and the design of the joint staff. In terms of what I'm working on, I would love to point folks to a new podcast I've launched with Radha Iyengar and Aaron Simpson called Bombshell, that is being managed by War on the Rocks. Our third episode will come out sometime this week. So if you go to the War on the Rocks homepage, you'll see Bombshell with three of the most fabulous minds in national security policy, and also some of the best pop culture references and discussions on what we're drinking. Highly recommend stopping by to listen to us, and I would love to get people's feedback on it.
Well, there we go. And I absolutely think everybody should grab the podcast. It's as I was talking with a friend of mine the other day, if you can't stand talk radio and you don't like pop music, you got podcasts, you got all the things in the world to keep you occupied while you drive around. And Lauren, this has just been a pleasure, a very informative, a very quick hour. And thanks again for coming on. And I think we helped shed light on a little bit of the background process that a lot of times people don't get a chance to chew on more than just the headline.
This has been great. Thanks to you both.
And thank you, Lauren. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today for another live edition of MidRats. And please join us again next week when we're going to have as our guest Claude Berube, historian, author, and director of the Naval Academy Museum. And believe it or not, in addition to the fact that President Trump hung a picture of Andrew Jackson up on his office wall, there's a fair bit about the Jackson administration's approach to the Navy that might inform us the direction that President Trump might be taking. And until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave this friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.
Hello! Hello!